This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work integrates research and field experience to prepare professionals to address today's most pressing problems in social justice, health, poverty, families, and global development. Applications are open for the early deadline of December 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
The Democrats' current position is that the only way the American government can reopen is if illegal aliens can get free health care.
President Trump is busy demolishing the White House to build a ballroom, but can't find a dime to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits.
I was notified by IDHS that my SNAP benefits might end on October 19th. It felt like a nightmare.
Hey, Chicago, it's Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the latest local news in and around Chicago after the conversation that you just clicked on. But before we get to the interview on what a pause in SNAP benefits due to the federal government shutdown could mean for local residents, let's zoom out a bit. In the Loop producer Linnea Dominick's here with me. She produced this episode, and we wanted to get some more insight into the wide-ranging impacts of the shutdown. Hey, Linnea.
Hey, Sasha.
Yeah, wide-ranging indeed. So many things are hanging in the balance here. SNAP, of course, as we'll hear later in this podcast, but also healthcare, right? Democrats want to keep enhanced tax credits that make insurance through the Affordable Care Act more affordable. But if Congress doesn't act, those credits are going to expire at the end of the year.
Yeah, it's a real doozy. And to make it worse, rates could also skyrocket. Insurers through the marketplace are set to raise premiums by 18%. This is the largest increase since 2018, the last time that there was uncertainty over federal policy.
Yeah.
And that's a huge deal. And this could affect about 400,000 Illinoisans. We're hearing reports of people having to make really hard choices. Are you going to afford heat? Are you going to afford food? Are you just going to have to go without insurance?
Yeah.
Until you can afford it again.
Very difficult questions to answer, you know, and the insurance, having insurance through the marketplace, that's touched so many lives across the country. I'm curious, have you had insurance through the marketplace?
Yeah, I was in a time of transition. I left a job where I had insurance, took a job where they didn't offer insurance. I wasn't working enough hours to qualify for their plan. I was also going back to school. It was a certificate program, so I didn't qualify for insurance at the school.
Mm-hmm.
And the marketplace insurance was a real blessing because I could still get insurance. I was able to go through the life transitions I needed to go through, and I felt secure knowing that I was still insured.
Transitions, that's a key word right now, and I think a lot of folks are facing, especially families with lower income, are just facing so many hits, I think, from state level, from the federal level, that this is such a huge deal. So health insurance is, of course, very much top of mind, but also important, as we've alluded to, is being able to put food on the table. So let's go ahead and get into that conversation about the future of SNAP. Thank you, Linnea.
Thanks, Sasha.
At the table, we had Aubrey Lewandowski, who's a SNAP recipient, and Nolan Downey, who's a senior director of policy for the Greater Chicago Food Depository. I started the conversation by asking Aubrey how exactly she found out about this delay in SNAP benefits.
The IDHS sends out a text that just notified us that if the government shutdown continued, that our reload for November wouldn't be available, could be delayed, or might not receive it at all.
So you found this out through text?
Yes.
And what went through your mind in that moment?
Just, like, at first, I'm like, is this real? Is this really going to be happening? I mean, we have the holidays coming up. I mean, between Thanksgiving, Christmas, everything. I mean, and even just the everyday things with four kids, I rely on those benefits to help us put food on the table.
Yeah. You've got four kids. Two of them have special needs.
That's correct.
Is that right?
Yep.
So tell us more about what SNAP means for your family day to day.
Day-to-day just ensures that they can receive all the food that they need, everything that's healthy. I mean, just making sure that we have all the food on the table and that they're never going to go hungry. I mean, they're growing kids. I mean, I got three of them are boys. I mean.
Oh, boy. So I have teenagers as well.
Yes.
No boys, but I know, I mean, when the two of them get together, that fridge is, or in the cupboards,
pretty empty pretty fast.
Yeah. I mean, I go grocery shopping big haul once a week and little one in the middle of the week because they eat everything.
Oh, I can only imagine. Yeah. So this is a big deal.
Yes. Huge absolutely. Deal.
So I teased there, Nolan, that SNAP benefits weren't cut during the 2019 government shutdown. Remind us why that didn't happen. And then what would be different about this time? Why didn't it happen again?
That's right. It's really important to highlight that this is a choice that the administration is making. At the Food Depository, we say that hunger is a policy choice, and there is nothing more illustrative of that than this moment. As you mentioned, we have had previous government shutdowns before, but we have never missed a month of SNAP due to government shutdowns. The federal government has access to SNAP contingency funds, somewhere between $5 and $6 billion that are exactly for this purpose, to cover a benefit shortfall if we are at risk of SNAP being disrupted. They also have the ability to reallocate other funds, like they've done for WIC for the month of November, to make sure that people on WIC don't have their benefits disrupted. So they have the ability, they have the resources, they have the experience to make sure that SNAP goes out in November, even if the shutdown persists. But they're making a choice right now not to do that.
You mentioned the contingency funds. This is interesting, right? That could cover this, but as you said, they're making the choice not to. The USDA said on Friday that this money is, quote, not legally available to extend regular funds and is not meant, it's only meant for natural disasters. Is there some truth there? What do they mean by this?
No, our assessment is there's no truth there. I mean, as you mentioned, they have experience doing exactly this in the past. So we believe that that is not a true statement and that those funds could be available to cover a great portion of the benefits in November and any other funds that might be needed to make sure that people can receive their full November benefits could be allocated by the department right now.
How is all of this sitting with you, Aubrey? Because Nolan put it plainly, they're choosing to withhold funds from SNAP.
Yeah, I mean, it's America is one of the largest countries. I mean, we have so much wealth here in America. One of the most basic human necessities is food. People cannot survive without it. Just looking at, I've discussed this too, like looking at other countries and how it's much more a collective with how everybody works together for food and just seeing how everybody only takes care of their own here is, it's absurd. And just watching that, how that, I want people to know how that can really affect real people. Just any family you see on the street, you never know anybody's story, but just seeing how that can really affect somebody.
Yeah, we also heard from Rachel Hoffman. Now, they're an urban farmer currently unemployed because of an illness contracted on the job. But here's what they had to say about the importance of SNAP benefits to them.
My healthcare costs are very expensive, like doctor's visits, medical testing, and medication. And SNAP benefits were a huge way I'm able to buy food that is healthy and supports my recovery.
So Rachel there brings up, of course, the expensive cost of healthcare, right? Because that's another thing hanging in the balance in addition to food assistance. But how the two sort of work hand in hand, Aubrey, I'm curious how that sits with you, because as you think about keeping your boys healthy, keeping your kids healthy and making sure. So what that means is making sure that you're buying vegetables and the proper snacks, right? It's not just chips and sodas and things like that. What's your reaction to having that kind of access sort of taken away from you?
It's a little just mind-blowing. I mean, there are other resources out there, like with the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Like, they have the food pantries and things, which do provide a lot of non-perishable, but getting the perishable goods is really, really what I rely on the SNAP benefits for. Those fresh produce, milk, eggs, cheese, these are not things that you always typically get through food drives or food pantries. And those are what growing kids need.
Yeah. Nolan, your thoughts on that?
Yeah.
The fresh, affordable, you know, healthy food portion of this, right? We're kind of missing that.
No question. I mean, we want people to be able to go to the grocery store to get the food that they need. At the Food Depository, we're really proud of the work that we've been able to do with our pantry partners throughout periods of heightened community need, whether that was during COVID, whether that was when we were welcoming new arrivals into the city. We're immensely grateful to our pantry partners and to our donors and volunteers that allow us to do that important work. But Sasha, I want to be clear. we cannot meet the need that would be created by people missing even a month of SNAP. 1.9 million people in the state, $350 million not coming into our state economy.
Mm-hmm.
We know that for every meal that food banks like us provide, SNAP provides nine. So we cannot meet this need.
Wow.
We are going to do everything we can, just as we always do, to make sure that people who come through our pantry partners' doors are able to leave with food. But this is bigger than we can
handle.
So
the Greater Chicago Food Depository is not equipped for this?
Not even close.
Aubrey, when you think about the fact that the food prices, we've watched them over the past at least 10 months or so, just really soar, right? We're all feeling the pain points of this. How is it going for you when you try to make the most of your food assistance benefits, right? When you try to stretch every dollar, are you picking and choosing what you pick up at the store? How are you working through that?
Yeah, I definitely look at who's got the lowest prices on everything. I shop sale ads, I coupon, I do everything I can to make everything last.
Yeah.
And then, when I'm putting everything in the cart, I'm keeping a running tally in my brain of how much is in there and how much I'll be checking out. And if something ends up being higher priced than what we thought, it goes back on the shelf because I have to make every dollar count.
November 1st is Saturday, this Saturday. Mm-hmm. Probably prime time for you to be going out to the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to fill that gap if this shutdown is still happening and your funds are not able to be accessed?
I work doing a lot of grocery deliveries, delivery driving. I'm going to have to be picking up more and more hours, which makes it harder with the kids because I do usually only work when they are in school. If they are home, then they do need to come with me.
Yeah. You do DoorDash, right?
Yeah. And so that gets increasingly hard, especially with children with special needs. I mean, I should be enhancing their abilities, doing things with them, not having to have them sit in a car while I drive around and do some more work.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, is it that easy to pick up extra hours door dashing? I mean, like you said, you're already restricted to the hours in which you can do mm-hmm. this based on your parenting schedule, right? So, I mean, so that's not necessarily a solution either, sounds like.
No, not really. Because especially on weekends, a lot of people do it on weekends. So if there are too many other drivers in the area, there's a lot less offers available, a lot lower paying offers available, and you rely mostly on tips.
Yeah. And here's the other piece, right, with DoorDash, you're also burning gas.
Yes.
At the same time, right? So it's like you go out there, you do more hours.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's like this weird hamster wheel that you're on, right? Because you're also spending more to put gas in your tank to do this. And if you don't have all the funds, how does that work out?
Yeah, that's just it too, is I account for that. I account for that. I mean, I go through about a tank of gas a day that I work. So money and gas prices being higher, then there's all the other maintenance on a vehicle. I mean, I have to go for oil changes every 6 weeks. I just had a major repair done on my car just yesterday.
Every 6 weeks?
Yes.
My goodness.
Yes.
My oil light is on right now, and I won't tell you how long I've had it sitting there. But that is a lot to consider.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lot to consider, especially on the heels of what's going on here. Now, here's another piece, Nolan. In December, the work requirements that were outlined in the Trump administration's so-called Big Beautiful Bill, they're set to go into effect, right? New work requirements for SNAP. Remind us what the major changes were.
Yeah, so I think it's important to remember that all of these crises are hitting people at once. People are at risk of having their premiums go up. People are at risk of losing their SNAP because of a shutdown in November. But then shortly after that in December, we're now going to start to feel the effects of the historic cuts that were made to SNAP and Medicaid through the federal reconciliation bill that was passed over the summer. And as you mentioned, the first thing that people are going to have to start dealing with is new expanded work requirements starting in December. So for people who are ages 18 to 64, who don't have any dependents, who are under 14, are going to have to start working or participating in some other work activity 80 hours a month, or else they only get SNAP for 3 months in a 3-year period.
Mm.
This is a very harsh work requirement. And that first month where people are going to have to start meeting or demonstrate that they should be exempt is in December.
Illinois has been able to waive the work requirement for the past several years. Are state agencies ready for monitoring or trying to enforce this?
We have had virtually a statewide waiver of this requirement since 2009. So we have very little experience as a state administering this policy.
Yeah, like how is this going to work in practice?
I know that we work every day with our Illinois Department of Human Services, and they are still very much figuring that out. As you mentioned, we used to have a waiver of this policy, but one of the things that the federal government did was end our waiver early. We were supposed to have until at least January 31st to figure out how we were going to deal with this as a state, but now our waiver is ending, and so their timelines are being moved up. So that's why December is now the first month that people are going to have to start dealing with this. And so it's been a scramble to figure out how exactly this is going to look. And we know that a lot of people are going to be harmed by this.
Yeah, folks, because, the ages that the work requirements apply to, that's expanded, right?
That's right.
How is this going to be communicated, you think, to SNAP recipients?
Yes.
Please don't tell me it's another text.
Well, I think text is one component. People do look at their phones, but I know that the department has also mailed people notices. They've mailed them an exemption form that they can fill out if people think they are exempt. And if people are listening, I think that is really the number one message in this moment. The department estimates that these work requirements could impact as many as 450,000 people in the state, but many, many of those people should qualify for an exemption. So if you get that form and you think you fall into one of these exemption categories, you need to communicate that to the department before December 1st, because then you won't have to be impacted by this.
What's going through your mind, Aubrey? Because here's another domino that's about to fall.
Yeah, I mean, from everything that I've understood and from what Nolan just explained, I would be able to have the exemption because I do have four children under the age of 14. However, I just look at other individuals maybe that do work like I do, doing DoorDash, other delivery or ride sharing or anything like that, because with the work requirements and needing to show that number of hours, it's very hard to do that with these programs because they only log your hours that you're actively doing an order, giving a ride to somebody. If you're waiting for an order and that's part of your time that you're taking out of your day,
absolutely,
that's not counted towards your hours that they log. So I could see that being a major hurdle for people to show their work hours to fulfill those work requirements if that is something they're not exempt from.
Yeah. Are you in touch with other folks who are also receiving food assistance benefits and maybe hearing sort of some of their concerns and fears?
Yeah, absolutely. I do have other friends who either have children who are slightly older than mine, so they wouldn't qualify for the exemption. Maybe they have children who are in high school.
Yeah.
Which still requires a parent to be there for a lot of things. They can't drive themselves. They don't have cars yet.
Oh, absolutely.
You have to take your child places, and they're not going to be exempt from these work requirements. I know people who without dependents who then wouldn't be exempt, and they do the ride sharing, and they see that as a hurdle.
Oh, my goodness. So both of you, I mean, are you hopeful this shutdown will end soon? You first, Nolan.
I think regardless of whether the shutdown ends, we're calling on the federal government to do the right thing, which is fund SNAP in November.
I mean, they could come to an agreement Friday.
They could come to an agreement today that they are going to fund benefits in November. So regardless of whether the shutdown ends, we implore them to do that.
Last word to you, Aubrey.
Same sentiments like that. I really do hope that they are able to fund those benefits, come to some sort of agreement to get this going because it's the worst time of year. I mean, it's getting colder out. Nobody should have to make the decision between whether they're paying their utility bill or putting food on the table. That's not something anybody should have to ever do.
Aubrey Lewandowski is a SNAP recipient from Palos Hills, and Nolan Downey is a senior director of policy at the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
Okay, now it's time to break down the biggest headlines and stories of the day. At the table was WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane and Dave McKinney, politics desk editor for WBEZ and the Sun-Times. At 10 a.m., Border Patrol Chief Gregory Bovino was expected in court. Here's Claire with a preview.
Bovino's been the public face of deportation efforts in Chicago. We've been seeing him all over the internet, all over social media, on the cover of the Sun-Times newspaper. And this is since the Trump administration brought Bovino here from California last month. So U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis, who has shown increasing frustration with the Fed's tactics, called the hearing at the Dirksen Federal Courthouse for this morning. The order came one day after Bovino was accused of tossing tear gas into a crowd in Little Village without justification. And after Ellis more than doubled the amount of time Bovino could be questioned under oath in an ongoing lawsuit, right? So she wants him to really come to terms with a lot of these questions head on. And a few weeks ago, a judge ordered the feds to issue warnings before using some of these crowd control weapons, such as tear gas. The order also ban tackling anyone unless the person poses an immediate threat. So Bovino was accused of violating the order as recently as over the weekend.
So I'm curious, Dave, what are you going to be listening for as Bovino answers questions?
Well, I mean, as Claire mentioned, this all starts in a little under an hour. I guess for starters, the biggest question is Bovino, is he going to show up at this hearing? Mm. I think there's, you know, that is always a possibility if he believes his actions are above board and he doesn't have to answer to anyone, that could be a tactic. But I mean, there's not been any kind of clear indication yet from the federal government about what his plans are. I would think it'd be kind of a mistake for him not to show up, and you know, certainly I think people assume he will be there. But I think when if that scenario unfolds where he's on the witness stand and Judge Ellis is asking him about, you know, why, for example, he chose to throw tear gas into a crowd in Little Village when she had delivered explicit orders that seemed to govern situations like that, it'll be an interesting question whether he, takes an argumentative stance with the judge, or if he offers any kind of contrition for that or explanation. Of course, all eyes are going to be on Judge Ellis about how she handles this interaction with Bovino. I mean, ultimately she has the ability to hold someone in contempt if they want to. But then the big question is, how do you enforce something like that? I mean, the marshals in the Dirksen Federal Building answer to the Justice Department, which President Trump controls. And so we've got kind of a dicey situation about to unfold over at the Dirksen Federal Courthouse.
Yeah, and even as you so eloquently, Claire, laid out all of the rules of this order, ICE and Border Patrol haven't slowed down at all when it comes to using tear gas. So this will be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen repeated use of pepper balls at the ICE processing facility in Broadview. Federal immigration agents were seen on Chicago's north and northwest sides on Friday in the Lakeview neighborhood throwing tear gas canisters. This was on a residential block after a crowd of people gathered to protest detentions. And then the Sun-Times reported this was a Halloween parade.
Yeah.
And the city's Old Irving Park neighborhood was canceled Saturday when federal agents deployed tear gas while detaining three people. Two of them ended up being U.S. citizens, and one was a rapid responder.
It's so clearly relentless. The go-to. Yeah.
Certainly.
Let's talk redistricting, Dave. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries was in town yesterday. Who was he meeting with, and what was the overall message there?
Well, he was meeting with members of the Democratic Illinois congressional delegation and a smattering of some state legislators. These were a lot of Black caucus members, both in the congressional delegation and in the state delegation. The message that he's trying to deliver is that in red states, Texas, Tennessee, Indiana, other red states, they're adhering to President Trump's request to try to redraw their congressional boundaries in such a way that would help Republicans in the midterm congressional elections. Republicans hold a narrow razor-thin majority in the House and hope to retain that in next year's elections. Mm-hmm. And Trump is pulling out the stops to try to help them do that. And so what Jeffries came to Illinois to do was, you know, given that Democrats control the legislature and the executive branch and the Supreme Court here, he's wondering if there is some way to try to get more Democratic seats in Illinois. Right now, The state has a 17-member congressional delegation, and Democrats hold a 14-3 majority mm-hmm. over Republicans. And the question is, could they potentially pick up one more seat here in Illinois by going after the three downstate Republicans and carving up their districts in different right. ways? I think the big question that Jeffries faces, however, at the state level, is concerns that some have raised about whether in redrawing congressional boundaries in Illinois, might it dilute minority representation? There are districts right now that are black majority districts, for example, and certainly there are black caucus members that don't want to see that representation diluted.
Right.
So one last thing about that is Jeffries was in Springfield yesterday evening, and met with Senate President Don Harmon and House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch to basically pitch this plan. But afterwards, when he met with reporters, he stressed that there's not necessarily a deadline to try to get this done during the veto session, which concludes at the end of at the end of Thursday.
Right.
So, you know, we'll be watching that, but it's very much in the air if we'll see action this week.
And tell us what we're hearing from Republicans downstate and Republicans across the border in Indiana, because we know Governor Pritzker and several prominent Democrats support the idea.
Well, I mean, it's kind of an interesting dilemma that Republicans face here, because the Republicans that are having this, you know, effectively done to them don't like it. In Illinois, they regard it as a potential power grab. Even though Republicans are doing it in other states, Indiana, of course, is an interesting situation because last week we had the Senate Republican leader there in the Indiana legislature saying the votes weren't there to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the last day or so, the governor of Indiana said, no, we're going to try to move ahead with this. So Republicans don't like it in Illinois, but they're doing it elsewhere. So it's a bit of mixed messaging for the GOP.
Claire, the fall veto session's entering its final few days in Springfield. Lawmakers are working to solve the financial problems for Chicago area transit, also trying to address high electricity bills, right? The top two items on the agenda for sure. What is the latest, though?
So Illinois lawmakers reconsidering the Clean, Reliable Grid Affordability Act. So this is due to the electric bills many Illinoisans have seen rising over the summer. Sasha's pointing to herself.
I'm also included. Pointing
to myself.
Yes.
Due to increased power demand from big data centers that are sucking up all of our energy. So now the state legislator considering that bill to help lower electricity costs by spurring growth of battery storage technology, which would absorb some of that power, store it when prices are low, and essentially put it back on the grid when prices are high.
Mm.
So the bill also helps to fund energy efficiency programs like home weatherization, and lawmakers are scheduled to close out the legislative calendar on Thursday. So we'll see what happens in the next couple of days.
Dave, do you think lawmakers will prevent this transit cliff?
Well, I think that they would like to. I mean, last week the governor signaled that he would, he thought that there might be some resolution to that by the end of Thursday this week, but we haven't seen any kind of details yet. There has to be a big revenue component here passed, and that always gets into a really kind of, you know, very questionable thing heading into election years,
mm-hmm.
whether legislators can muster the courage to do that or not. So, you know, these veto sessions especially can be feast or famine. I mean, there are a number of things on the calendar here from the, you know, the mass transit issue you talked about to what Claire was just speaking about with energy to redistricting, even stuff involving a response to the immigration enforcement crackdown that the federal government is doing here. And right now, we haven't seen really details on any of that. And
yeah.
So you become kind of, it becomes a question in your mind, is 3 days enough to really kind of pull together, you know, what really in all of those cases are complex pieces of legislation and do it properly.
Right. Well, they got to do something. What other stories are you watching, Claire?
Well, we love to joke about Chicagoans beginning their hibernation season,
mm-hmm.
especially with daylight savings on the horizon. It's sort of nap season. But the Lincoln Park Zoo has two new hibernators, adult brown bears.
Oh,
the first
nice.
At the zoo since 1979. Ash and Lexi, they are an aunt and a niece from a zoo in Madison. The Sun-Times says the duo were taken from the wildest cubs. They were designated unreleasable. This was by officials in Montana after learning to raid trash cans and becoming dependent on human food. So the girls are
unreleasable.
Yes, unreleasable due to being yogis a little bit. Basically. But they're gearing up for their winter. This is called a torpor, which is a process very similar to hibernation. So if you're not hibernating, you can go to Lincoln Park Zoo and check out some new bears.
Check out some new brown bears. Thank you, Claire. Before we wrap up, Dave, I want to touch on the trial of Sean Grayson. Now, this is the former downstate police officer who shot and killed Springfield resident Sonia Massey. And this is a case, really, of a white police officer fatally shooting a black woman in her home. In a bit of a twist, he actually took the stand. So what did we learn from that?
Well, it you know, whenever a defendant in a criminal trial like this takes the stand, it's always a bit of a Hail Mary by the defense here, because they, you know, sometimes it'll be they feel like they have nothing to lose. Other times it's a situation where they're so sure of their innocence that they think that they have the ability to prove to the jury that the charges are made up. In this case, what Grayson had to explain for himself is why he went so suddenly into this mode of shooting someone. He fired three bullets and fatally injured her. What we've learned at this trial is that, the wound that killed Sonia Massey on her kitchen floor was a bullet shot that went right underneath her left eye. It didn't graze her brain, but it hit her carotid artery. And the fact that she bled out on her kitchen floor, as gruesome as that is, we heard testimony from an expert, a forensic expert who did the autopsy on her, that she would have survived that had first aid been applied at that point. She could have survived it. And so right now we're entering this phase in this trial where we're seeing this morning closing arguments, and the case should land in the lap of the jury this afternoon.
Okay.
And it's going to be a question of, you know, do we get a quick resolution to it? Because the video recording from the body cam footage of you know what the police showed of the shooting was incredibly jolting. The jurors in this court, they recoiled when they saw this woman being gunned down in her home. Right. So the impact of that, I think, is something we have to watch, and how quickly they arrive at a resolution.
And Dave, if Grayson is convicted, what could he face?
Well, he faces three first-degree murder charges. If he's convicted on those, then it could be life in prison for him.
WBEZ's Dave McKinney and Claire Lane.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.